Last Sunday, we looked at the subject of faith in God is logical. There is a mistaken notion that faith is the setting aside of reason, and we reject the idea of blind faith. Faith is based on evidence. And the reason it's called faith is because of the element of trust. Trust in a creator. And we hope that we demonstrated that adequately. The message is at church@vienna.com. Now it's church, C-H-U-R-C-H, A-T, not the symbol, Vienna, as in what's on the signs here, .com. For those that missed it and would like to follow up. Now, whether or not one can prove that God exists is a matter of debate because the word prove, right? You know, it's just impossible to gainsay. And in a world where 2 plus 2 equals 4 is being challenged, how can you prove anything? But what we hope we've demonstrated is that belief in the existence of God is certainly reasonable, even logical. Further, we attempted to show it is the most reasonable, the most probable. It's most probable to assume not only that God exists, that's logical, but to assume that God is intelligent, aware, volitional, he has will, he does things deliberately, morally sensible, and interested in his creation, that he would be communicative, and would have communicated with humanity by now. We just recapping a bit that we walked through this series of reasonable assumptions and steps logically that would lead us to those conclusions. We reject the notions of anthropomorphism. Do we remember that one? That's a charge that is made by people who are incredulous, who don't believe in any creator. Sigmund Freud is a famous one. He believed that man created or invented God out of his own needs and insecurities. But that is a mistaken idea, which history can demonstrate. Rather, belief in God is first of all an attempt to understand how the world came into being. It's first, and everything flows from that. So rather than an anthropomorphic anthropology, right, study of man notion, we believe in a theomorphic notion, that man as a creature reflects some of the properties of the creator. We'll talk about that again. We infer that any creator, craftsman, architect, artist, or otherwise, communicates a lot about him or herself in his creation. And so we uphold the biblical notion of theomorphism. Now, people have properties that are similar in some way, some lesser way, to the creator. For example, a client of mine said that a design that I proposed was too masculine. I was a little startled, but I instantly saw, yes, she's right. Now, whether it was too masculine or not, objectively, is one thing, but it was too masculine for her taste. It was a masculine design. Arts and crafts design tends to be that way. And so I designed a chair that was much more feminine, curves. And she loved it. And they got a set for their table. This notion, I mean, you can see it everywhere. Study great art, great architecture. Remember one of the last trade shows I was at a few years ago by now, I suppose, where, you know, it was an exhibit quite large at one of the major centers in Toronto. And it was a long show, 10 days. I catch my son's eye because he was there with me. And after a few days, I noticed a pattern. A profile. I noticed that about 70 to 80% of the people that came to my furniture exhibit and expressed a particular interest all had similar characteristics. It was fascinating to me. Perhaps I should have anticipated that. The men were very much like me. Minus a beard, maybe. But in their age, their attire, their intellect and interests, right down to how they walked, I began to be able to spot them in a crowd and pick them out right down at the end of the aisle. It was fascinating to me. something about me as a person was expressed in my furniture designs, and it resonated with others that were similar. It's not that we have invented God with human properties. Rather, it's reasonable to infer that God has imbued us with many properties, attributes, and characteristics that are similar to his. Let's keep an eye on a clock here. Those that know me know I need to do that. Let's proceed with our journey. If reason leads us to conclude that an intelligent creator made the universe, God, and we further reason that this creator has revealed much about himself in his creation, including us, and we reason beyond that, that it is most probable that this creator has already communicated with us, including in the universe as created, then we ask ourselves, can this God be known by us? And that's the title of our subject this evening. I had thought previously to title a message, Which Religion is Right? But because it's an often asked question, if you're speaking with a secular person who is overwhelmed at the variety of religions and apparently competing claims, even within Christianity, as it is called, a poor title in my view, there are so many different sects, and you know, which one is right? It's a fair question, but in answering the question, it just seemed too competitive to my ear. And we're not in a competition. As fellow human beings, we want to help one another in the quest for truth. Brothers and sisters in a very large human family. Reason leads us to deduce, to conclude, the creator that is in many respects similar to the God of the Bible, in the attributes of power and knowledge and those attributes. Some of the details and the interventions and so on that the Bible claims, they still need examination. Just because there is reason leads us to many of the same things that are therein set forth does not mean that we just swallow the whole book without scrutiny. So let's reason together. Let's help each other through this often difficult journey of life. As the Bible invites, let us reason together. So, can this God be known? The most probable assumption is yes. If you remember, we moved from the logic of syllogisms to probabilistic arguments, right? Syllogisms are logic, major premise, minor premise, conclusion. And, right, famous one in algebra. How many of you loved algebra when you were in school? A few. Well, yes, you've got company, Deborah. If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C, right? And some of you are lost already that hated algebra. Let's put it this way. If 2 times 3 equals 6 and half of 12 is 6, then 2 times 3 equals half of 12. Right? If this, it's just logic. There's no guesswork involved. It's irrefutable. And we moved through that. That which begins to exist begins to exist, must have a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe had a cause. Remember, we discussed that last week. We looked at another one. The universe began to exist. Endless regression of causes is a logical impossibility. Therefore, the cause of the universe must be uncaused. And if it's uncaused, it is eternal, abiding. And we extrapolated from there. So that's logic. Then we went to probability. It is most probable that a cause that produced intelligent beings would have intelligence. So that is a deductive and probabilistic argument. And we're not saying then that we have absolutely proved, and you'd have to be, you know, silly to doubt or foolish. We're not abusing people. We're pointing out that it is very, very, very reasonable. It's compelling to believe in a creator, and it's very reasonable to believe that this creator can be known. The most probable assumption is yes. And we infer this, as we've previously done, by observing that a creator that creates so many communicative beings is likely to be communicative. Even trees communicate, so those that study them tell us. And I don't mean that they have souls, although famous Japanese-American woodworker wrote a book, The Soul of a Tree, which I have. I don't mean that, but chemically, if a tree encounters a tragedy, a disease, it emits a particular chemical that the wind carries to trees further down the chain that initiates and triggers a resistance and a response that helps make those other trees survive that disease. This has been studied and known. Even trees communicate. It's most probable that the creator communicates as well. It's most probable that the creator would be sociable in some meaningful way. And so if our answer is yes, a creator can be known, then the next most begging and obvious question is how? How? I would submit the most obvious answer to that is to seek, to pursue, to at least give ourselves to. We've got to start somewhere. We commonly do this when seeking for a spouse, a soulmate. We reasonably, most of us, assume that there's a match for us somewhere in this planet of allegedly over 8 billion people now. Or we at least trust that our paths will providentially cross. That's most people. Not everybody wants to be married, or not everybody thinks it's likely for them, but most people either go looking or expect that providence or just luck or the universe, somehow our paths will cross, and so it goes. So in looking for relationships, we recognize that there is a process involved. Remember a previous deduction. It's most probable, given the duration of human history, that the Creator has already communicated with us. This is the most likely already. He has, in the universe, he's expressed a lot about himself in the material world. But given that there is direct communication, not just that of the artist, the craftsperson, the architect, but so much direct speech, whether in written form and poetical works or just direct interaction, it's most probable that there has been verbal communication to these verbal beings from a creator that is most probably verbal. And so we would then look at the texts that exist, the histories and the poetry and the various statements. And there are several substantial volumes from different religions. And they all have significant overlap, but significant differences. And how would we discern them? But we should look at them to see if there is reasonable evidence of any of them being communication from a creator. Are you with me so far? Is this just, as a teacher, you always watch to see if the eyes are glazing over, right? And it's a really depressing sound if there's a thud of a forehead hitting a desk because they've passed out. I would submit that here again, the most reasonable assumption is that the texts that most effectively address the deepest needs of mankind are the ones most likely to be from a creator. Let's say follow the reasoning, right? We've got a highly communicative creation, which points to, deductively, a highly communicative creator. And since there's verbal communication and textual communication, then it's highly probable that creator has given some communication like this. And given how long human beings have lived, it's most probable it's already been done at least once. So we want to look at the various claims. Now, there is high overlap, but there's some significant contradictions. To examine them all is to recognize they can't all be true. Notwithstanding, most, if not all of them, have many great truths in them. They can't all be true as volumes. So how would we discern? And it would seem at the top of this list that those texts, whether in one volume or several, that most effectively address humanity's greatest need would be likely to be from a creator. Why would we make this deduction? Again, I would submit theomorphism, the idea that the creator has expressed things about himself in us. And in as much as it the most common, or it is most natural to most human beings to want to help another creature in need, it would make sense to believe that our creator would want to help us in our need. Do we follow that? Did I explain that clearly? We, as a species, even whales, and we won't take the time to look at the many anecdotes of creatures acting in benevolent ways. But whether you see a little child hurt, how many, somebody that the time would fail to talk about, people who can be otherwise mean, cruel, will stop to show kindness to someone who is really in need. It's a very, very universally common, although not without exceptions, human trait to help someone in need. We can therefore deduce that a creator who would most reasonably be interested in his creation would want to help in their greatest need. So let us look then at what will effectively address humanity's greatest need. And I hope you're thinking we haven't yet established what that is. What is humanity's greatest need? Well, let's look at that in a little bit. Let's recap to where we're at so far. God is knowable. That's our most reasonable pathway. Creation, that is, what exists, teaches us about the Creator and should be studied if we want to know more about the Creator. So we're reasoning together, right? This study of apologetics is not the way we teach our children, you know, to apologize. You did something wrong, apologize. Say, I'm sorry. Maybe I should have done more of that with my children, but if I discerned that my boy was not sorry for what he did, I never told him to say he was sorry because I didn't want to add lying to his other sins, right? He's going to just say he's sorry when he's not. Now I'm adding hypocrisy. So I sought to lead them to recognize what they did was wrong and to regret it and to apologize. Hopefully I was successful in that. But apologetics, an apology is to give an account, to give an answer, to give an explanation. It comes from a Greek word, apologia. How am I doing? Is that? Thank you for that. I'm not a Greek scholar by any hallucination of the imagination on that. Apologia, right? And that is referenced in the writing of the Apostle Peter, that Christians should be ready to give, written in Greek, an apology to everyone that asks, a reason for their faith. It's to give a reason, an explanation, an account. And so apologetics is a study of Christians giving a reasonable account to those that are interested, whether in a curious way or a combative way, a reasonable explanation of why they believe what they believe. And that's what we're hoping to do here. And we've deduced then that God is knowable, that creation teaches us about the Creator and should be studied with a view to knowing. We've established that it is plausible that at least one religious text contains divine communication. We consider that it is most probable that a divinely inspired text will effectively address humanity's greatest needs. Doesn't that make sense? Imagine a divinely inspired text, and all it did was be the most magnificent poetry and didn't give us any solutions to our fundamental problems. That would seem negligent. So I submit it's most probable that this divinely inspired communication will effectively address humanity's greatest needs. We further suggest or infer that it is a worthwhile pursuit. The most noble pursuit is the knowledge of God, especially compared with other pursuits such as the search for intelligent extraterrestrial life. We could look at that. I was looking at it last night, actually. And perhaps we'll take a slight diversion from that. The organization called SETI, S-E-T-I, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And the incredible technology both of transmitters and signal detectors. Over 100 scientists engaged in this organization's search for intelligent, advanced civilizations out in the galaxy. They attempt to send signals to alien civilizations in case they exist. This is happening right now. They are monitoring the universe for signals that are coming from elsewhere. So far, they've perceived a lot of radio waves that are the result of planetary magnetic fields interacting with their stars and dwarf stars and all sorts of very sophisticated cosmology. And these radio waves come in and they're naturally occurring. I read an article by National Geographic, and that was interesting. Headline, December 18th, 2020, alien hunters detect mystery radio signals from a nearby star. That's grabbing. And, but you get, certainly, you get one or two sentences in, and they say it's almost certainly not an extraterrestrial telegram. Astronomers are searching for life beyond Earth, and they've spotted something strange. Unexplained radio signal appears to be coming from the direction of the star closest to the sun, about 4.2 light years away. And I did a little search. Rockets can travel about 25,000 miles per hour, and it would take about 112,000 human years to reach the nearest star. With our current technology, 112, if we could get the fuel and the material fatigue, wouldn't, you know, and how would we ever get to live that long? 112,000 years at 25,000 miles per hour. There, they found it exciting that there's an Earth-like planet orbiting that star, what they call an exoplanet. That is a planet orbiting a star not in our solar system. And while researchers caution that it is almost certainly these signals that they've been discovering in December of 2020, it's almost certainly of human origin. Even a remote hint of life beyond Earth has people excited. Why? Quote, it's aliens. It's awesome. These are people with PhDs in physics, and they are spending their entire careers searching for intelligent life in the cosmos. So far, in over 60 years, nothing. Well, what about this? Well, it just so happens that The following year, they discovered that it was either a radio, a phone, or a computer in Australia. That's an October 30th, 2021 story on the exact same signal in the NPR. The same National Geographic article had another click one at the bottom, which I didn't read. Alien life is out there. Can AI, artificial intelligence, find it? Now, what an assertion, because there is, at this point, zero evidence that there is alien life. None at all. And yet they make this bold assertion. It will help us to understand, and I say this not to denigrate anyone, but it is a fact in our day that there is an attack from many within the scientific community on religion in general. I made reference to Richard Dawkins sponsoring the advertisements, the ads in the United Kingdom, not on bus shelters, but on the buses themselves. He didn't initiate the campaign. That was by an atheist comedian. But he jumped on it, supported it morally and with his voice, and he pledged to match each donation, pound for pound, to a maximum of 5,500 British pounds sterling for this ad campaign. Well, they raised over 140,000 pounds, and they filled the United Kingdom with buses saying, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." So there is this hostility, pushback, and no doubt some of it is very valid and very deserved. They're pushing back over centuries of abuse of society by religious hierarchies, Christian, professing Christian, and otherwise. So we're not, there's some understandableness there, or some sympathy. But it's hostile, and it's not true. I mean, at least he said, there's probably no God. Richard Dawkins is quoted as saying, "I wanted to say there's almost certainly no God," but he got cornered into probably because it's more catchy and more memorable, and perhaps more scientific. You know, the ancient prophet Isaiah reproved people about 2,500 years ago or more who lived saying, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." This is not a new idea. This has been a thing with a large portion of humanity. Not a large percentage, but a number. This life is all you got, so just seek maximum enjoyment. And that is a very poor way to live, as we want to consider. It's a bit of a diversion. All of this expenditure looking for intelligent alien life by scientists who mock, as Richard Dawkins did, at religion. The thing about religion is that you don't think if you're religious. It's a shame. It's disappointing as a notion. It's combative, as are many of his writings. But I would submit that if it is considered worthwhile and reasonable to spend millions and millions of dollars and your entire career searching for life in the cosmos that you have no evidence at all exists, then it is certainly reasonable to spend your life seeking the knowledge of a creator that logic insists exists. That fair assertion? And that reason would lead us to consider is sociable, communicative, benevolent, and able to be known. So it is a worthwhile pursuit, the knowledge of God. And more strongly, and follow this thought, please, it's very important. It is a moral imperative to seek to know and to do the will of the Creator. It's a moral imperative. Why? Well, if there's a Creator, and logic tells us there is, then the stuff of which our bodies are made belong to that Creator. Just look, your hand, consider your air, everything. It's all the Creator's stuff. This has strong social taboos, but I'm going to say it anyway. Our bodies are His property. That's a big contentious issue in Western civilization. In Western law, it used to be a thing where a wife was her husband's property, and that's very offensive in our modern sensibility, and very understandably so. But I'll take it a step further. All of our bodies and everything on the planet is our Creator's property. And we are beholden to our Creator. It's His stuff. It's His air. It's not ours. It's His land. It's not the First Nations land. It's not ours either. It's His planet. It's His galaxy. It's all His. And we have a moral duty then to not misuse someone else's stuff, including our own bodies. I hope we'll consider that further. It's said with some humor, but it is a morally compelling thought. Our bodies are made by a Creator with material that He has made and has rights to. And in our discussion, I'm using He as a long-established grammatical, the male pronoun used for the neuter. We're not assuming in our discussion the Bible. We're reasoning together in English. Our bodies are made by Him with material that He has rights to. Thus, we have a duty to pursue the knowledge of God, not an entitlement to pursue our own pleasure. What I'm hoping is that all of the reasoning behind this is self-evident as we walk through it. Then to not seek God is to be negligent. And I would offer this as a strong counterpoint to this idea there's probably no God, so just enjoy your life. And what would you say then, whoever would make this assertion, to the person who says, well, if there is no God, then I am not morally accountable to anybody, and what gives me pleasure is something that's really going to upset you? Would violate your human rights. That's another subject. Where do human rights come from? We mustn't go too far down this road because we're constrained by time, but go into the certain parts of British Columbia where you find a grizzly bear, and when it's attacking you, demand that he respect your human rights. And tell me how that works out. This is an absurd concept, unless you believe they are given to you by a Creator. There is no solid philosophical basis for rights that do not derive from a Creator. We'll overlook some more of these details. I want to say this as we are considering, you know, you have two tracks here. We have atheistically derived scientific pursuit searching for intelligent life in the universe for which there is no evidence and logic does not direct us to, contradicting whether mystical or religious or metaphysical, spiritual pursuit of the knowledge of a Creator that logic does tell us exists. And we have seen why some of that is. It's interesting, I was talking about this with my family this afternoon, that the same people, you could put them opposite halls in an academy. And on the one hand, when you have a religious person, and they make this the cosmological argument and the fine-tuning argument, right? These are known facts of the universe that it is so extremely remote, the possibility that life could exist in the universe, human life, intelligent human life on the planet Earth. It's so remotely unlikely and improbable, no less a luminary than the late Stephen Hawking said, it appears that the entire universe has been specifically designed and created to sustain life on Earth. He was an atheist. That's how improbable it is. And you cross the hall and you have SETI saying, oh, for sure, there are thousands of or many, many other civilizations just like ours way out there. It's not coherent. And it stems from what Aldous Huxley, if you recall from last week's, asserted, that he wanted to believe in a meaningless universe so that he had justification to do whatever he wanted. And that does seem to be driving a lot of this, with the result that people are watching. Oh, you know, this whole idea is probably no God, and they're going to prove it soon. And at the very least, it keeps reasonable people from having confidence that they can walk knowing a creator by faith, because science is going to prove that's all wrong soon. A promise that in 200 years they have failed to deliver, I might point out. At the end of literally a full lifetime of intense pursuit for intelligent life, physically discernible in the cosmos, they have found exactly nothing. Some hoaxes. They discovered, with all of this expensive equipment, a microwave oven, signals coming from a lighthouse, even a Russian military satellite. It's all bread and circuses. Contrasting this, I submit that the most noble, the most reasonable, the most compelling, in fact, the highest duty of humanity is to seek and to know Creator of the universe and to do His will. This Just Enjoy Life campaign is very misguided. Everything else pales by comparison to this most noble pursuit. We are faced with a binary choice. The meaninglessness that Aldous Huxley presented, or creation. When I say presented, he exposed it, right? He said the quiet part out loud. I had reasons for wanting to believe in meaninglessness. Meaninglessness is the shorthand for the scientific hypothesis or notion that the universe, the material universe, came into existence without a creator behind it. The universe created itself out of nothing. Why did he call it meaninglessness? Because if the universe is a result of blind, impersonal, accidental forces, there is no transcendent meaning to human life or anything. An asteroid hurtling through space, a snake eating a frog, a mother giving birth, a man saving a child, a monster abusing someone else. All of these are just physical phenomena in a random universe that has no purpose, no meaning, and no value. That's meaninglessness. You and I might decide our lives have meaning and impose some meaning on the world, but that's simply our subjective will. It has no intrinsic value. Good and evil are up for grabs. Sharks kill, and so may you. Everything is simply matter in motion. That's meaninglessness. And either that is true or there is a creator. And that notion has implications. Right? Meaninglessness is the end result, the inexorable conclusion, the undeniable unavoidable conclusion that if the universe came into existence without an intelligent volitional being behind it, then nothing has meaning. You can make up whatever you will. But if there is a creator, that has inexorable implications. One of them is that everything that exists, including our bodies, our minds, our emotions, our will, belong to that creator. And with that comes a moral duty to that creator. Those are the binary choices of life. Do as you will, or do as the creator wills. It really boils down that simply. Thus, if we should study creation, and we should also examine religious texts. Before we examine religious texts, we should determine criteria. Number one, as we've said, is does it effectively address humanity's need? Thus, we need to identify humanity's need. And I trust, this is not a controversial notion, that if we survey human history and current events, we would conclude that humanity's greatest need is moral. It's not, for example, world poverty. There are resources in the planet to end poverty globally today. The obstruction to that is a moral one. It's the selfish, cruel choices that many human beings make that cause world poverty, or poverty in parts of the world, to persist. Every evil act is a result of moral choices that human beings make. What causes these moral evils? Some think, it's all environmental, but I think under scrutiny that fails. Time, we'll perhaps examine that in more detail when we have the time for it. Remember Epicurus, who sought to make the gods irrelevant because of his belief that the two most damaging psychological forces were vice, immorality of all its forms, and fear of divine displeasure and retribution. So he sought to teach people, don't do wrong, and God's not interested in you anyway, so you won't be punished. So that's how he proposed a solution. But 2,000 years later, that has proved to be a very limited effectiveness. It does have some limit. People that abstain from vice do much better. And people who don't think that they will ever give an account for their sins don't struggle as much with the fear of death. That people who think they have a lot to answer for. So there is some merit to that, but ultimately it fails. We could argue that selfishness is all wound up in that. Greatest human need, moral need. We have a need for well-being, spiritual, emotional, physical, mental. And that which addresses this need must be an effective cure. Not just suppression of moral vice. You know, where do moral evils come from? They come from within the person. How many times have we seen somebody go from some manifestation of anger or evil towards someone else when they're not worried because they're with people they know, and then a stranger comes and they put on a different persona? I remember in my teens seeing the boss just reaming out the staff. And then ding dong, customer walks in, he goes through the door, hello, big smile, beaming as if he's just beside himself with joy. I used to worry about him. He couldn't get his anger out fast enough in his speech. I thought he was going to have a heart attack right there in front of me. This fakery. Suppression. This is not a cure. What is it that people will express such meanness to the people closest to them? Jesus talked about those who have been forgiven much, love much, and those who have been forgiven little, love little. And one of the things we can extrapolate from that statement is that not everybody has the same degree of moral failure. But I don't think it's controversial that we all have moral failure. And what is the cure for that? So, whatever religion we pursue must have an effective cure. At least if it's going to come from a creator, we can reasonably expect there to be an effective cure for our greatest need, which is moral. And it comes from within. Now, to wind down and leave time for questions. Review, when seeking God, we've established, I trust, that this is a moral imperative, both the most noble pursuit and a moral imperative. We're not looking for feelings or sensations or any kind of experience. We want to know a knowable God. Remember, we talked about epistemology, that intellect is not the only means of knowing. There's also emotion, intuition, and sensation. You can know something intellectually. You can just feel it. I'm getting that kind of a vibe. You can somehow intuitively know something. It's like a quantum leap. Just you arrive at the right answer, bypassing all of the steps. Physical sensation, they all work in their limited spheres. They can all be wrong. They can all be right. And it would seem then that our knowledge of God should be agreeable to all the ways by which we can know the world. I submit that we should be humble in our pursuit of God, lest we become illusioned. It would seem futile to impose expectations that are incorrect upon a creator and then recoil when they fail. This is, I believe, what happened to Charles Darwin. What I've read of him is that his dear sister Annie was deathly ill. And he fervently prayed for her to no avail, and she died. And that began his disillusionment with God. Finished his life an agnostic or an atheist. And while I can sympathize, it must be dreadful to have a loved one die, and why did not God answer my prayers? I would submit that that is a unwise approach. We should approach with humility, not demands. And we should be persistent. We'll talk about that later. We reject blind faith as unreasonable, but rather we embrace the warm invitation of the ancient poet, taste and see that the Lord is good. Jesus uniquely addressed the problem of sin, and we'll study that in a detailed way in subsequent messages. To the skeptic, the invitation is to taste. If one is doubtful of his claims to divinity, try his teaching. Look at the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's Gospel, the first book in the New Testament, chapters 5 through 7. Live it, all of it, and see what happens. Taste. There's no demand in Christianity or the Gospel to believe blindly something without evidence. We're skeptical. Taste. Well, what do you say? Try before you buy. God is not unreasonable. That would be unreasonable to think God was unreasonable. I remember one man, he's long since died now. He's a preacher, and a young man asked him, what happens to newborn babies if they die? Do they go to hell? What a question. The preacher said to this young man, well, what would you do? He said, oh, if I was God, I wouldn't cast an innocent baby into hell. He said, well, don't make God to be less than you are. That seems to me very reasonable. What do you think? Faith in Jesus is based on evidence. We'll look at that evidence later. But I believe biblical truths applied to life will lead one to conviction. That will lead one to faith. That will lead one to receiving the Spirit of God. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Well, we went a little over time, but we still have time for questions. I do have one written here, but are there any questions from the floor? Last week we had some. Here's one. What should I do if I have sought God, made an honest effort, and still nothing? Seems a reasonable question. What would you say to someone like that? Well, here's what I would say. Keep at it. There may be any of a number of different reasons why we aren't finding, but we should persist. I mean, if you lose your car keys and you can't find them, what do you do? It depends how urgent it is and desperate, but you're really going at it with a will. So I think we should persist. Give an example, and you know, my advice to you is don't be born to parents where that you've got a parent that's a preacher, because you'll get used as a sermon illustration. So, and don't marry, well, I shouldn't say don't marry, do marry a preacher's kid out of compassion. So my son-in-law, my most newly acquired son-in-law, in pursuing my daughter, our daughter, what a hilarious story. So he came very chivalrous and gentlemanly to ask the parents, you know, may I court your daughter? And, so I said, okay, well, so I talked to the young lady, and she said, tell him I have no feelings at all for him. I'm not attracted to him at all in that way, and I probably never will be. And that's what I did. She didn't think I had done that clearly enough, so she followed up afterwards and told him that herself, in plainest language. And but if you want to continue under that basis, you're welcome to try. He said, yep. So he did. He wrote letters, handwritten letters on parchment, and went out to visit her because she's left the province now. Way to make it hard on a fella. So he goes and he stays at a bed and breakfast nearby, and he takes her this way and that way. He wasn't going to take no for an answer. He flew across the country to go and visit someone who says, I just don't love you and I don't think I ever will. I like you as a friend, but I just don't, I can't see myself ever wanting you for a husband. He said, that sounds like yes to me. And off he went. He won her heart. She is head over heels. Oh boy, there is not a better man in the world. She tells that to me. I said, well, you can argue with your mom over that one. I would say this. If a man will pursue a human being with that kind of determination because he sees someone desirable, this is a kind of woman I want to marry, don't you think we can at least justify encouraging that level of purpose and never say die, don't take no for an answer, in the pursuit of God? Isn't that reasonable? I really like my son-in-law. I'm so blessed. You've got competition for favorite son-in-law status, but you know, that's good. Being told plainly, not interested, and thinking, we're going to do this. Friends, we should not let silence or, you know, I prayed and I didn't get a miracle, so I just gave up. I'll say this about my daughter. If he had been the kind to give up at all, they would not be married today. And not because she's hard to get or anything like that. What are, you know what I mean? What how is it? People that are just difficult. Not that, but just, I think it's something. There was a demonstration of love and a manifest sincerity that could not be denied. And other things that were so winsome. You know, as human beings, we can deceive ourselves. Is that reasonable to notice that? Anyone? I mean, don't give me a show of hands. But nod if you know another human being, or if you know a human being that you could reasonably think has at some time or another deceived themselves. You can nod. Is that Yeah, only a few nods, no? Some of you have lived a very sheltered life. We can want something and justify it. We could be lazy and justify it. So often we don't know our own hearts. And by allowing us to have to persist in the face of an apparent silence, one of the things our Creator may be doing for us is purifying our hearts from the fickleness, from the double-mindedness, from the selfish reasons, from the preconditions, until we have the right reasons. The Apostle James wrote this. Some of you pray, I'm paraphrasing, some of you pray and you don't get an answer because you ask, you're praying for the wrong reason. You're praying out of selfishness. And by persisting, these kinds of things become evident to us. And we begin to persist out of a more pure motive. Jesus said, and countless people through the millennia have discovered, seek and you shall find. He was talking about seeking God. Persist. I trust we have demonstrated the reasonableness, nay, the moral imperative of the pursuit of God. And I would encourage us all to make that our lifelong practice. I'm brought up short with the fact that my negligence with my back exercises that resulted in pain was a failure and neglectful. There are enough minutes in the day to faithfully do my back exercises. Not, oh, I was too busy. And it is more so the case that we are not too busy doing our duty to seek God. Rather, we are more often too lazy or have poor priorities or other reasons. And so I would encourage us all to be honest with ourselves and to engage ourselves in the most noble pursuit of God. Shall we close in prayer? Our time is gone. God in heaven, we thank you for life and breath and the opportunity to live, even in this country, of such relative security. And what better way to make use of it than to serve God and man. Help us all, dear God, as we seek to know you and to make you known. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. With that, we're dismissed. We don't do coffee and cookies at the end of an evening service, but we're all welcome to stay and visit and chat and encourage one another. We'll be dismissed with that.